This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. We say it every week, but it's true. We build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And sometimes we kind of end up with an accidental theme, don't we? This week, be warned, it's creepy crawlies.
It is minus 8 this morning. I'm Mark Stevens, standing here in the car park in Aberdeen. The other side of the fire, well, practically in the fire, Rachel Stewart.
Yeah, good morning, Mark. Good morning, winter. That's definitely indeed happened over the last couple of days. Right. And actually, you know what? We've had some lovely weather. I quite like when it's really cold and crisp. It was a stunning sunrise yesterday. When you're out and about, there's been no sort of nasty biting wind. So it's actually been very pleasant to be
out. No nasty biting insects either. They've all fallen to the ground long since.
I've got no, I'm having none of this. I was actually defrosting the car this morning, which took quite a lot of effort, I have to say, about 4:45. And one of the neighbour's cats appeared out of one of the cat flaps and was only out for about, I'd say, 6 or 7 seconds. But yeah. No. Straight back in. It's going, where's my cosy bed?
Very sensible. Coming up, we've got not one, but two rare beasties in the programme this morning. Plus, we're digging up the past with the Inverclyde Time Teamers and an archaeologist at the site of the Monastery of Deer, which they found.
Yeah, I know. It's absolutely brilliant, actually. I love how enthusiastic they are about it as well. Plus, I visit a farm with a difference. You'd like this, because it's in a shipping container.
Oh, I like shipping containers.
Ah, you do, you do. But I got that one so tough. First, as always...
Too much of this happening.
We've got a mystery sound for you. Let's have our first listen of the day. You think you know what it is?
I do.
Yeah, okay. We'll leave it there so you don't blow it for everybody else. Email us.
Probably just blurt it out there.
outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Or you can text us 80295. And a rather frozen-looking Owen has entered the building, ready to take your calls on 08085 92950.
He was happed up to the nines, so he was.
He was, and I don't blame him. I had so much clothes on this morning, I was a bit worried that my big jacket wouldn't actually zip up. Anyway, here we are. Now, a rare and elusive ant, which hadn't been spotted in Deeside for 70 years, has been rediscovered in large numbers in the area. The shining guest ant, I suppose, is a bit of a cuckoo, as it only lives in the nests of wood ants. Globally, the species is considered to be under threat, so the news is understandably causing a bit of a stir. Dan Brown from the nature company Wild Discovery was the first person to spot the insect. I spoke to him and his wife Rachel on the Invercold estate, where the little creatures have been in abundance this year.
Well, they were on our radar for a few years. We've done some work with the Cairngorms National Park and the Invercold estate to try and expand the knowledge of wood ants in this area. Very little work had been done. So we undertook a whole suite of surveys across the estate on this side of the Cairngorms, and we found a lot of wood ants. We had a lot of Scottish wood ants. The majority where we're standing now is a lot of hairy wood ants. Yeah, we didn't see any at that point during those surveys. But Dan and I come out a lot just into this amazing area. You can see for yourself, it's absolutely beautiful. So we walk out a lot. We're always on the lookout for little creatures. We're interested in absolutely everything. And it just so happens that one day Dan was out on his own and was looking and then found one. And
what was that like?
A little bit of a surprise. So as Rach said, we'd spent hours and hours and hours looking at wood ant nests, both for structured surveys and just incidentally. And this bit of habitat in the Invercargill State is just incredible. I mean, there's so much here. And just one day I happened to glance down at a nest and there was this tiny little shining dot amongst all the wood ants. And it completely took me by surprise because I thought I'd checked most of these nests around here. And so I got down a little bit closer. I had a camera with a half-decent macro function on it, and I was trying to take shots of it, trying to work out if it really was a shining guest ant or if it was quite a similar slender ant. And I was 99% sure it was a shining guest ant. So I called Rach, we only live 400 metres away, and Rachel came across. She brought a little specimen tube and a magnifying glass, and sure enough, we got one into a tube and confirmed that what we thought was a shining guest ant. And they're beautiful. I mean, they're tiny, 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 so a couple of millimetres long, with this really shiny amber-coloured body. And they're so reflective that you can literally see yourself in the abdomen, the reflection on the abdomen. But we needed to get full confirmation, so we got a lot of better shots of them. We sent them off to a number of experts, and Dr. Jenny Stocken, who's based at the James Hutton Institute, came back to us and confirmed that, sure enough, this was shining guest ant, and a complete and utter surprise.
And very exciting, because they've not really been spotted here since 1952.
No, there's, very old records, and I think some people had been out to look for them since then and not recorded them. But the really fascinating thing is there's one nest that we'll show you in a second that is not a massive nest in the grand scheme of how big the nest can get. Some of the Scottish wood ants can get over 2 metres tall, you know. Some
of them are quite big. Huge!
It is. They're impressive, impressive structures. But it was the numbers that we found on this one nest in particular. And the numbers have far exceeded anything ever recorded in the rest of the UK before. We've found over
500. Yeah.
Just in one visit. And before that in the UK, you know, only tens had been recorded on any one nest. So that in itself is pretty spectacular as well.
Yeah, this is the hot spot then potentially in the UK. Mm-hmm. Shall we go and have a look at
Definitely.
The nest?
At this time of year, because we're going into winter and the ants will hibernate, but they tend to retreat down into the depths of the nests where they have their food stores. It's much more regulated from a temperature point of view. Their temperature, believe it or not, they like to have between 25 and 30 degrees.
Okay.
Which I think it's, 3 degrees today? It's quite.
It's a bit nippy for them, isn't it?
So I can't see any ants, but you can see quite an obvious entry hole here, and there's nothing lurking around the edge of that. Now, they need a bit of heat, a bit of energy to get them going. And on warm days, the whole surface of this mound, so we've got, probably 2 or 3 metres squared here, would just be alive with ants. I mean, literally thousands and thousands of wood ants and up to 500 shining guest ants on it. And all going about their business, you know, bringing in thatch, bringing in food, and the shining guest ants doing the same.
Mesmerising to watch, aren't they?
They are, and we have been here with our bottoms in the air, heads down, watching them for literally hours. Not good for the back, but fascinating to watch all the interactions between the shining guest ants and the wood ants. It is fascinating. We could watch these guys all day.
And the wood ants, we don't fancy eating them then?
No, they don't. And this is really interesting. So if any other insect basically drops onto the nest mound, the ants will grab it, they'll take it inside and it'll become a piece of food. But the shining guest ants aren't impacted at all. I don't actually know. I presume they produce a pheromone that basically dissuades the ant from eating them or masks their true identity. But if you watch really closely, you can see the wood ants. They'll occasionally come up to the shining guest ants. Sometimes they completely ignore them. They tread on them. And the shining guest ant is able to live literally side by side, even to the extent where they can take food out of the mandibles of the worker wood ants' mouths and then take it off and presumably take advantage of it themselves.
Yeah. And you've captured some video of it because I was watching it last night.
We have indeed, yeah. My geekiness. I've been out and about with the camera and the macro lens and trying to actually get a few images and a few bits of video. And this is during the peak when the females, the winged females, were out and about on the nest. And you've got males here coming in. They're desperately trying to mate with her. Wood ants just cruising by, just completely ignoring them. But you end up with this cluster, this frenzy of activity, a ball of ants all intertwined. We also watch the females here trying to break off their wings. So you have Flying Ant Day, and most people really don't like Flying Ant Day, but it's really important because that's when these animals are leaving their nests and potentially going to relocate and start new nests. But when they do, they get rid of the wings because the wings are a real inconvenience inside a mound like this. And so they do everything they possibly can to break their wings off. And we watch them trying to trap their wings under their back legs and basically twist and turn, force them and pop them off. And it's incredible, really, to think that something has evolved these beautiful wings, because ants are Hymenoptera, so they're related to wasps and things like that. But then they're going to the effort to then break those wings off so that they can live a more efficient life in a nest mound.
Dan captured amazing images of them. He really did, pin sharp as well. In fact, they were able to identify that they were shining guest ants just from those images. Well worth a watch if you're interested in them. And you can really see their shiny body and the really rich amber colour that they are. And they look like giants in the video, of course, until you see a wood ant next to it. You're going, oh yeah, you're actually really, really, really small.
Really, really small. Yeah. You know, this never crossed my mind before. Why don't you get flying spiders?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Is that a question for me, or are you just throwing it out there for the listener?
I'm just chucking it out there to the group.
Well, you know who would be able to answer that question? It would be Dr. Jenny Stalken. Now,
right.
She's an insect ecologist at the James Hutton Institute, and she actually confirmed that these are shining guest ants. She's been eager for a sighting of them in Deeside for many years because she's been, suspecting that they've been there for a long time.
They've just
never actually been able to see them because they've got to rise to the surface. She talked me through the identification process in her lab.
Well, there's various methods we use to identify things. One of the main ones is to use a dichotomous key. So we've got some books over there, these are two books about British ants.
Can you give me an example of that? Yeah.
One's a bit easier than the other. This is the slightly older one.
Tiny writing.
Tiny
writing.
For
my middle-aged
exactly.
eyes.
Well, yes, exactly. Let's go to the... So we would just start at the beginning of the key. So it's got two choices, and it's whether the waist has only got one segment or whether it's got two segments. So in the terms of the shining guest ant, it's got two segments, so that immediately takes us to a couplet further down the key, and then we'd keep following that until it brought us to a species name. So that usually works quite well. The other thing we use is reference material. So we've got a number of different ants here. So these are the wood ants that are found in the UK. We've got a couple of queens there, so you can see the size difference.
And these are actual ants?
No, these are not models. These are actual ants that we've collected in various ways. So you can see a queen with her wings on, one without. She'll shed her wings once she's mated and then fall in a colony. And then we've got three different wood ant species here. We've got another two species here which look like wood ants, and they're just for us to compare and contrast. And this little thing here could be a shining guest ant, but it's not. It's another little tiny ant that is found occasionally in wood ant nests, but it's quite wrinkled. So if we were looking at the shining guest ant versus this one, we would just look at the sculpture of the body, and that would help us to distinguish which it is.
And you'd need to do that with a magnifying glass or under the microscope.
Absolutely.
Or something.
Yes.
They're absolutely minute.
These are really, really tiny ants. We're talking about sort of one millimeter, 2 millimeters. So really, really tiny. So yes, for sure we would use, we've got a microscope here, which
You're
goes up to,
turn it on.
I'm going to turn it on. It goes up to 150 magnification. So that's it turned on. And we've actually got some shining guest ant in this tube here. So you can see how tiny, utterly tiny they are. And then we can put them under the microscope. And then we can have a closer look at them. And instantly with this ant, in this one, we don't need to go through the key because it's so obvious. When you look under the microscope, it's so shiny. Just lives up to its name and the size of it as well. And the fact that it's on wood ant mounds, we can almost instantly see what it is.
Now, you must have been pretty excited when you got this, because they'd not really been seen in Deeside for about 70 years.
So the last record was 1952. So that was a long, long time. And I've been studying wood ants for 25 years now. And I've been looking and looking, because I thought they have to be here. There's so many wood ant nests on Deeside in old woodland, which have probably been there for a long, long time. So it had to be there. But the more we looked, we just couldn't see it until this year, where it turned up at Crathay. And yeah, and I couldn't believe the numbers. And it was so exciting to go out and see, because I've seen nests before over on Speyside where you see maybe one individual, and you're hunting for this one individual. But going out to Crathay, and they were just everywhere. They were just everywhere, crawling up posts, and it was just a phenomenal sight. We don't know what's caused this mass emergence this year. We don't know if that's normal for that site, because Dan has looked there before and not seen them. But they've presumably been there all this time. So something's happened this year that has caused this absolute mass emergence of so many individuals. So it'd be really interesting next year to go back and just see what happens. It's a really elusive ant, and we only see it when it comes to the surface.
You obviously identify insects all the time. Are you ever stumped, because there are more than 20,000 of them in the UK alone?
Yes, I am. And it's actually quite nice, because I like that problem-solving aspect of it, because we go through hundreds and hundreds of samples here, hundreds of specimens. So when you see something different, it just sparks your interest again, and you're going on a sort of problem-solving mission to find out. And yes, we can use keys, we can use reference material, but sometimes we are just completely stumped. We have to go to other experts, we have to share photos or specimens, and then eventually we'll find somebody that's just seen that thing before and knows what it is. I mean, we always live in hope of finding a new species. I haven't yet.
But you learn new stuff about insects all the time, don't you? That in itself must be exciting, even if it isn't a new species.
Absolutely, because you find things turning up in places that you wouldn't expect them to be, because you can read all the textbooks and you can speak to all the experts, but sometimes something just doesn't add up, it doesn't fit, and we can't always believe what's in the books and what people have seen before, because things do change. And we're actually part of the Environmental Change Network, so we monitor lots of different things as part of that, but one of the things we look at is ground beetles. So we have a long-term data set of ground beetles from the last 30 years, and we monitor that year on year, and we've seen just huge declines in the beetles, so that's quite alarming.
Have you always been interested in insects? I mean, you've got a number of toy insects at your desk here.
Yes, I was one of those geeky children who at the age of 12 decided I was going to become a lepidopterist at that time. I went to the Edinburgh Butterfly Farm at the time and did some work experience, and then was just utterly hooked. And I was really lucky to be mentored by other people that were interested in insects. And then when I came to university, I got into ants, and then that has just been one of my groups that I just love. I mean, insects, they're just integral to how an ecosystem functions, and even to us as well. I mean, they pollinate our food, they recycle things, they aerate the soil, they are food for birds and other wildlife. So, and they're edible to us, some of them, as well. So they just perform all these fantastic functions without us even thinking about it. So, yeah, we would be absolutely lost without them.
Dr. Jenny Stockin there from the James Hutton Institute.
Yeah, she is an ant enthusiast, to put it mildly. She's got models of ants on her desk. They're giant models. They're like something out of a horror movie. But she's just such an expert. She just loves it. Yeah. Loves it, and has loved it from a really young age as well.
They are remarkably, remarkable communal animals. Mm. You know, and obviously different species, you know, operate in different ways and what have you. But the extraordinary structures they can create.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a wood ant's nest is amazing to sit and watch. And they're huge. Some of them can be absolutely huge. And of course, they think that they're all linked up as well.
Yeah.
You know, Dan was pointing out a little tunnel that had been created linking one to the other, which I probably wouldn't have noticed. But obviously, he's got an expert eye.
That's off in the way, though. Anyway, You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Rachel Stewart. Coming up, a multitude, a host of mushrooms.
Yeah, I like that. I like the alliteration there, multitude of mushrooms. And, of course, today's mystery sound. Let's have a listen.
Fiona in Erskine thinks it might be a woodpecker.
Ah, yeah, I quite like that idea. So does Sandy. I think it's a woodpecker. I can see why you'd think that.
And Hamish Christie in Dalwhinnie says it's minus 8 there. He reckons it's a capercaillie.
Yeah, good. Fiona in Gearloch, where it's a balmy minus 3. She says, is this mystery sound a thrush chopping a snail on a rock? I like the creativity of the guesses. Get in touch if you think
they're
you know
wrong,
what it is.
The way,
they are all wrong, yeah. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is the email. Text us 80295 or give us a ring 0808 592 9500.
Last week, we'll be discussing hutting here in Out of Doors with author and broadcaster Peter McQueen. Peter's family have got a hut, but you can't approach it by road. You have to get there, basically, by water. So they have a wee boat, and they also have a couple of canoes. I met Peter and his dad, Graham, early one morning to make that journey, which begins under a rather special bridge.
My dad keeps the canoe down here like a wee troll, under keeping his canoes under the bridge.
It's very convenient. It makes it easy to get to the hut.
It is a cracking bridge, though.
No, that's the bridge across the Atlantic.
That bridge is 225 years old or thereabouts.
Whenever I ask my dad if I can head down to the hut for a weekend, he always talks to me about the tides. And you have to be aware of the tide when you're coming here because it can be tricky to paddle against it. Yeah. Especially if you've got a bag full of, you know, your supplies for the weekend. But it's a good workout.
This is the hard bit. Once we get past this bit, it eases off, it widens out, and so the flow of the tide is not as strong. Yeah. And of course, depends on the tides. If it's a spring and a neap tide, and the moment we're in between, it was a full moon last week, so there was big, big tides. Mm-hmm. Here's another heron on the shore here, eyeing us up carefully. There are so many of them here, and they're here for a reason, and that is there's ample source of food here. And today it's difficult to see that, but when the water's still, you can see lots of small fish in the water. There's such a flow of water through here.
Where is the water coming from and where is it going to?
This is the island of Seal on our port side. So the tide around the British Isles, the tide floods to the north. So it floods up the outside and through the inside here, through Clachan Sound. When it reaches the north end of Seal, it curls around and floods back down the way. So uniquely, you get a flood to the south in this particular part for about 2 hours before high water. Okay. And that's what we're experiencing right now. We're just before high water. We're heading north, and yet we're going into the flood. Yeah. And that's because the tide curls around the north end of Seal and floods down through Clachan Sound.
Just drops back down here.
It's such a beautiful place, though, Mark. Who would want to go abroad in an aeroplane when you could come here in a canoe?
It's the colours at this time of year as well, though, because you know, everything is just classic autumnal colours. Lots of coppers and warm tones, golds. You know, even the greens are starting to warm up, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Was your career on the sea?
Yes, I went to sea when I was left the high school, the local high school, and I had a very successful career in the Merchant Navy. And then I went to America as a marine surveyor for a few years. And then I came back home and became a removal man. I had 35 years running a small removal company. That was good.
He knows everybody locally.
Oh, man.
Not only does he know them, but he knows how to get the sofa in and out of their house.
We are now probably about 400 yards away from the bridge across the Atlantic, and a little bus has just crossed it. Now, the reference you made to keeping the canoes underneath, like, you know, the troll and the billy goat's gruff, That's what the bridge is like. I mean, it's the most humpback bridge in Scotland, probably. At one stage, the bus was pointing straight up, and the next stage, it was pointing straight back down again.
Coming down here on an evening when it's very still is very, very beautiful, and the reflection of the bridge and the water, it forms a complete sphere with the reflection and the hump of the bridge. I grew up around this bridge and played as a child here, so this place was very special. However, trying to find a piece of ground can be difficult. I was very fortunate to be able to buy a bit of ground up here. My wife's in a wheelchair.
Okay.
And I've got a special needs brother lives with me. And when the hut was built, I also had my mother, who was quite elderly, living with me. So it gives a great escape for them.
Is it basically accessible by somebody in a wheelchair?
Yes,
okay.
But not in a canoe.
No, no.
I've got a specialist boat with a ramp at the front. So, and again, of course, she's limited with the weather and that type of thing. But for her to come down here and spend a day in a remote location like this is wonderful, where most of her days she spends sitting in the kitchen at home, in a chair, all day, every day. So to get down here is a very special release for her. And my special needs brother just revels in it. And he comes in the canoe.
Oh, see, that's interesting, the rock at the side there. Because, of course, we're quite close to the Slate Islands.
This is the north end of a seam of slate that runs through many islands, known locally as the Slate Islands. Mm-hmm. And the slate industry was a big industry in this part of the world in the 1800s. Up until 1905, there were 25 men employed here at what was known as Glenalbin Slate Quarry.
Is this us coming into the hut now?
Yes. Look, you can suddenly see it.
You can.
The part behind you there is the slate spoil from the quarry.
Okay.
Those many thousands of tons of slate spoil has been dumped and formed a big ridge right behind us here.
Okay.
It makes it a particularly interesting place for me because you see the angle of the shore here. It's a nice shallow angle, which when in a wheelchair is quite important.
Quite.
I think we have to get out now.
That's all right.
Excellent.
If you'd like to hear more about Peter and Graham McQueen's hut, and it is a cracker, then have a listen to the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, available now on BBC Sounds. It basically, Graham got a whole dose of really good quality double glazing that somebody was getting rid of, and doors and things like that. That largely provides the front of the building, and then it's a single sloped roof back. You know, and they have a sleeping platform, you know, up top and what have you, and it's wood-lined, so comfortable. I would love it. Absolutely.
I know. You mentioned last week that you had a serious case of the old envy.
Oh, yeah.
I really like that the hutting adventure begins long before you even see the hut.
Yes.
You know, yeah. I think that's really, really nice.
Right. We've got some comments here. I've spare a thought, if you will, for Tim Gardner. And his family, saying, my family and I have been listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast for a year, as we've been planning a trip from our home in New York in the States. We finally made it to Scotland on American Thanksgiving, and we've been exploring Helensburgh, Appin, Oban and Fife. Thank you for your highly engaging programme and helping us get ready for the trip of a lifetime. We can't wait to continue listening while we're here, and once we return home to the States, Tim Gardner and family. Tim, don't be fooled. It can get cold here too.
Yes,
this is unseasonably warm weather.
It's gone. I feel almost guilty if we've enticed them over here and it's -8 today. We've also got a mystery sound for you this morning. Let's have a listen.
Heaps of wrong
loads
answers here.
And loads
Fred
and
Gordon
loads.
And Armadale thought it might be a woodcock.
Yeah, I like that one. -7 degrees in Elgin, apparently. -8 here, so we beat you. It says, is it your teeth chattering because of the Baltic weather?
Probably. Lynn and Carmine D'Agostino, or Carmine D'Agostino, says, my husband thinks the mystery sound is a squirrel warning of danger.
Nice.
What's that, Skippy? A helicopter in the ravine.
My other comment was from John. Denise and Phil say they're visiting family in a snowy Falkirk this morning. Is today's Mystery Sound the series, the start of a series of cartoon-themed mystery sounds, beginning with Woody the Woodpecker this week? Next week, Muttley from Wacky Races.
From Marty and a chilly Cooper Angus says, is a sound of an ant chapping at the door of the nest on a frosty morning wanting in after a night out?
I like that one
as well.
There's
a lot of that in Inverurie last night.
Yeah. Dennis Scranton says, could the mystery sound be an oyster catcher tapping on a window at its reflection?
Greg Wilson in Cardonald says, good covering of snow this morning down here in Cardonald. I had two blue tits nesting in a box this year and the sound reminds me of the chicks scrambling about in the bird box.
Good guesses so
far.
Good
guesses.
Yeah.
It's
a minor thing, yeah. Get in touch, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or give us a ring. Keep Owen entertained, 0808 592 9500.
Dundee's Museum of Transport is currently housed in temporary premises. It's got a new home, but that new home is in need of some serious repair. The building, which is pretty magnificent, as a former tram depot, which looks a bit like a couple of red brick Mexican churches placed side by side. Paul Jennings is executive director of the Transport Museum, and he very kindly got the keys out and showed me around.
We're standing outside Merrifield tram depot. The building's clearly quite big from the outside, but people still refer to it when they come in as almost like the TARDIS, because people expect it to be a long, thin building. The building's actually 120 metres long in length, but it's also very wide as well. Yes. And the space that we're standing in, roughly the first half of the building, is the area that will accommodate the new Museum of Transport.
Just looking at this, you know, the structure of this, you've obviously done repair work to the roof because there's new sarking up there. Some of these sort of truss ends have been replaced. You know, that's basically been sort of sectioned in. Across there, you've got metalwork holding this up, but the walls look really damp.
Yes, the building's been empty for probably 30 or 40 years at this point. The museum has owned the building since 2015, so about a year after it opened in its current facility, which was always intended to be a temporary home. But as part of that, there's been an annual requirement to have a structural engineering inspection. One of those inspections late last summer identified that there were changes in the roof structure. And so that resulted in a piece of work between January and June of this year at the cost of about £280,000 that has addressed some of those structural challenges. The main one actually being that several of the roof trusses had dropped, some of them by up to a metre. So with the weight of the slate on top of the roof, that basically meant, you know, it wouldn't take too much for a collapse. And then it's unpredictable, essentially, when a roof of this size collapses. So that really spurred us into action. You know, this structure is now stable, substantially weatherproof, waterproof and pigeon-proof, but not quite there yet.
Not quite pigeon-proof, because there's still a few kicking about. Yeah. It's interesting. It's a double span. The centre of this is held up by these, I think they're metal pillars. But is that guttering running down through the pillar?
It is quite ingenious, actually, if you think of this part of the building going up in 1901. So we basically have a central valley within the structure joining these two buildings that you mentioned. And we have two of these are drains that historically would have taken rainwater down and away from the building. As part of a number of different surveys that we're undertaking at the moment, we will be sticking cameras down to see what's left. We suspect there probably won't be much there. And Historic Environment Scotland have indicated that they would be happy for us to look at an alternative means of moving away the water in future. Yeah.
As I understand it, this is the good half of the building. The other half is through there.
Yes,
and you've had a roof collapse through there, or partial roof collapse.
Yes, the building was built in three sections. So the largest part was built in 1901, mm-hmm. Then with additions in 1913 and 1920, I guess, with the growth in need. But the whole building was essentially designed to accommodate up to 70 trams in its heyday.
Wow.
It gives everyone a sense of the scale of the building.
The bad half of the building is sectioned off from the good half of the building by this big sort of tarpaulin sheets.
We'll take a look in this space.
But not wander through it. This is identical to the other side, but a lot of the roof here is being held up by structural scaffolding. I mean, and there, those ends have rotted away completely and the roof truss has dropped by probably nearly a metre in that case. The walls here are much damper. The floor is damper.
But it's got good bones.
It has. The walls are remarkably straight for a building that has some issues with the roof. Once restored, we will tell the building story as part of the new museum as well. So we actually have some of these rotten truss ends ready to put on display themselves. But in this section of the building, it will require a new roof ultimately.
I just parked around the corner. I was walking up the outside of that wall there. And you can see the sort of classic evidence of damp within brickwork. It's delaminating. You know, the face is basically falling off, essentially, of each individual brick. You can see ferns growing in the gaps, and there's buddleia all over the place. You know, the butterfly's friend, the building's enemy.
Yes, the brickwork, as you mentioned earlier, is very distinguishable as a Victorian building in that sense, that sort of red brick structure that you associate with Victorian buildings. But the brick is actually relatively porous, and certainly compared to the surrounding grouting. So it basically means that, you know, the brick is more inclined than the grouting to absorb water, and in weather like we have right now, when that water freezes, the brick really has nowhere to go because of the grouting, other than to fall off the front of the brick.
Just the face explodes outwards, essentially.
That's right. So around the building, there are little pockets of brick debris on the floor.
So I walk through drifts of the stuff.
Yes, yeah. So the plan is, we think in the Victorian building alone, there are about 2,500 of those bricks that are going to need to be replaced. So we have sourced a supplier. The bricks are going to cost about £1 each, but obviously there's wider work in terms of cutting out existing bricks. We've also done some analysis on the grouting as well. Obviously, there's also a wider plan in terms of replacing guttering and downpipes and all of these sorts of things. For a building that's 120 plus years old, we think once all of that work is done, it will actually see it good for hopefully another 120 plus years.
And your cunning plan is you want people to sponsor a brick.
Yes, as part of a wider campaign to fundraise, we've recently launched a crowdfunder specifically for the bricks. So people can sponsor a brick. We've roughly put a value of about £10 per brick, and we need 2,500 of them. So it's a £25,000 campaign. We're only just over a week in, and we're already at about 85% of target, which is incredible, actually. We've had donations from £5 to £10,000, believe it or not, which is incredible. And many, many positive comments as well. People who've got memories of the building, but also people just expressing a desire to see the museum move and this building saved.
Paul Jennings, the Executive Director of Dundee's Transport Museum. I described the brickwork and the two, you know, the two tram sheds, etc. But in the corner, just as you go in, you know, in the old Victorian part, there is a downstairs office and then an upstairs office. Uh-huh. You know, approached by a sort of stairway. It's all built of wood. You know, it's all painted a sort of slightly, you know, pastel green colour.
Okay.
Fantastic. I mean, just a lovely. I mean, that is Victorian.
Yeah.
And it's as sound as a pound.
Yeah.
Sound as a pound. I mean, as I said, the building's got good bones. I would love to see it back on its feet again. There's a lot of work needing done to it, but it's doable.
Yeah, well, it looks promising if they've managed to get to 85% of their target already and they're only a week in. Yeah. I'd actually never heard of this museum, and I think I know Dundee reasonably well.
You worked there?
Oh, yeah, I did, yeah. And obviously my husband isn't aware of it either, or we'd have been visiting this place. So
yes.
I'm looking forward to it opening and hopefully being in this building.
Well, as Paul said, interestingly, it was built in three stages.
Yeah.
The oldest bit is the best bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's the bit that survived best out of the whole lot. So
yeah.
I think that tells us something.
I mean, you didn't even get around to discussing the collections. Who knows what they've got in there, what hidden treats they've got.
You know, what excitement. We heard about the discovery of a rare ant earlier in the programme. We're going to move on to another interesting invertebrate here, the medicinal leech. It's been confirmed that they've been found in three locations, in Dumfries and Galloway for the first time. Joining us to tell us more about the medicinal leech is Craig McAdam, Conservation Director with the charity Bug Life. Craig, nice to have you on the programme again. How are you?
It's nice to be here. Thanks, Mark.
Could you just describe a medicinal leech to us?
Sure. So medicinal leeches are they're related to earthworms, but they're much more flattened. They've got two suckers, one at each end of the body, and they're a dark colour, but they've got lines and dots on it in a lighter colour. They live in the water. They've got, they're they've got three. They've got this. The front sucker's got a mouth in it with three jaws, and those jaws hold about 100 teeth. So quite different from earthworms, but distantly related.
And they're quite big, aren't they?
Yeah, they can grow up to 20 centimetres. Obviously, they stretch out when they're moving. They do this sort of looping motion where they attach their suckers and then move along. And as they stretch out, they can be quite long, yeah.
Why are they called medicinal leeches?
So it goes back in history. They were used in medicine in the 17th and 18th centuries. The 1700s and 1800s. And they were believed that if you removed the bad blood from your body, it would cure your ailments. So they used leeches to actually attach to the body and then take out the blood from patients.
Sorry if you're eating your breakfast this morning. They used to be quite widespread in Scotland, didn't they? What's sort of happened to them? Is it because of that use that's seen a decline in their numbers?
Yeah, they were widespread across the UK, but in the 18th and 19th century, they were harvested for medicinal use, and there was hundreds, thousands, millions of them used over in a year. Some of the records from the continent show, you know, multiple millions used in hospitals in Paris, for instance, every year. So they were really harvested, exploited to extinction. We thought, you know, in the 1970s, they thought the medicinal leech was extinct in Britain. It was rediscovered on Islay, actually. And since then, we've found about 20-odd sites.
Are there indications of where they might have been in the past? You know, I was trying to think of place names that had the word leech in it.
Well, yeah. So I've been looking at that, and I've been going around surveying places that are called Loch of the Leech. In Gaelic, Loch Nandela is effectively Loch and Leech, and there's about 28 of them around Scotland. In Scots, it's a gael is a leech, so Loch Gelly is a leech loch. And I've been going round looking at them, but I've not found any in them apart from the one site that we have on Islay, which is a Loch of the Leech.
So it's pretty significant then that they've now been found in, I suppose, what we think is a new location.
Absolutely. We had records over the years of people saying there's a big leech, you know, attached to me, but we'd never had any confirmation. And then this local naturalist, Bob Merritt, collected one by chance when he was doing another survey and sent the photos in. And we went out and confirmed it, and he found it in two other ponds. Next year we're going to be looking to see if there's more in the local area.
Aside from giving you the heebie-jeebies, would they do you any harm?
No, not at all. They may break the skin, they may feed on you if you go in bare-legged, but if you're in waders, if you're fishing, or if you're in a wetsuit, they may attach to you, but they won't be able to break the skin.
They don't like the taste of neoprene?
No.
Tell me a little bit about this captive breeding programme then that you've got going at the Highland Wildlife Park.
Yeah, so we are part of a project called Species on the Edge, which is a big project that's focusing on saving species that are threatened with extinction. Across the programme we're doing stuff on birds, plants and lots of invertebrates. This is a partnership project. There's seven organisations involved in it. And we are focusing on six threatened invertebrates, and one of them is the medicinal leech. And we're working with the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland to set up some conservation breeding. So we've collected 14 leeches from a loch near Oban. They've been taken up to the Highland Wildlife Park, and they're now settled in and are just getting ready to mate in the spring. And then hopefully we'll have some juveniles later on in the year, next year.
What do you feed them on?
On blood, put into a sausage skin, and then they attach to it and feed as they would on a human.
Absolutely fascinating. And you know, the one question I want to finish with is, you know, are they still used medicinally?
So not the medicinal leech that we have in Scotland. That is fully protected. You can't do that. But you can't collect them without a license from Nature Scot. But the there is a leech farm down in Wales which produces a very closely related species, which is still used in medicine. It's used particularly where they need to improve a blood flow. So, for instance, a skin graft or something like that, they'll use leeches to keep the blood flowing.
Absolutely fascinating. Listen, thank you very much, Greg, again for joining us. Much obliged.
No problem. Thanks.
Yeah, they are fascinating, aren't they? Just the fact they were used in that way in our history. We'll definitely have to have a visit to the Highland Wildlife Park to see these leeches.
And the sausage skin full of blood.
Yeah.
Some very clever folk out there.
They are. You know? Very much so.
You think it'd just be quicker just to stand in there and let them feed?
You thought so. Well, you could try that when you're there. Now, moving on to something else. Have you ever tried to grow mushrooms?
Not edible ones. We've had a massive crop of, you know, fungus this year.
Yeah.
I mean, just, they're all over the shop, you know, on the grass, on the wood chip, everywhere there has been fungus. It's been a real good year for it.
Yeah, well, there's a group in Edinburgh, they're called Rise Mushrooms, a community mushroom farm, and they do the whole growing process a bit differently because they, in inverted commas, they turn trash into food. They use urban waste in their cultivation process and they grow these mushrooms in a converted shipping container. I met Mim Black and Marco Tancone, who explained how they set all of this up.
We decided to start a community food growing project during the pandemic and quickly kind of settled on mushrooms as being really uniquely suited to an urban context, and took a lot of inspiration from looking at how around the world people have set up mushroom farms in really marginal spaces. By marginal, I mean like places that don't really have a lot of social use, maybe are like cheap or free because like they're not currently in use, like abandoned basements, or, you know, famously indoor mushroom cultivation was pioneered in the catacombs of Paris, which were completely disused and then were turned into these huge mushroom growing grottos. And you know, we had a lot of time and energy and motivation but no money, so we were looking for somewhere we could set up a project rent free with very few resources, and Edinburgh rent is very expensive, so we realized that we could buy a secondhand shipping container very cheap. We got ours for £1,300. And that gave us, you know, a solid footprint to start an indoor cultivation project. And we can kind of move it anywhere, very flexible, nomadic in that way. And we came across this site, which has been in community use for 8 years now.
And explain where this site is, because you can probably hear some banging and clattering in the background. That's workmen.
Yeah, so we're towards the end of the Union Canal in the Fountain Bridge part of area of Edinburgh, on the site of the old Caledonian Brewery. So this is actually basically the last kind of ex-industrial plot that has not yet been developed as part of the kind of Fountain Bridge canal side redevelopment that has been going on since this part of Edinburgh was deindustrialised in the 80s and 90s. And yeah, the council own this land and have been sitting on it for a very long time waiting to develop it, and the development has been delayed for all kinds of reasons over the years. And yeah, about a decade ago, some local community organisers got in touch with the council, looked at this big empty plot of land and asked whether they could make something of it. And then in 2022, we showed up with our shipping container. So we're the third community project to set up on the site.
And it's a very colourful shipping container. It's bright yellow, about 40 feet in size, is it, Mim? Mm-hmm. Why is that ideal for growing mushrooms?
You can kind of grow mushrooms at any scale. This is the one that we have, that we've found, and we've retrofitted the inside of the container into a mushroom farm that really suits our needs. But yeah, you can grow mushrooms in your cupboard, on your kitchen table, all the way up to like air hangers. But yeah, this is what's worked for us the best so far. And I think, yeah, the main draw of having a shipping container was that we would be able to move it, because we knew that eventually we were going to have to leave this site.
So are you able to open up and we can have a little look inside? Now I'm not sure if this is exactly what I expected it to look like.
Yeah, so we're kind of like in the antechamber. We call it the foyer of our farm, which is basically just used for storage and also has like our control unit, which regulates the airflow and humidity of our main fruiting chamber. But yeah, we store a lot of our substrate here. So substrate is the growing medium, both like the food and the home of the mushrooms we cultivate.
And what are then those bags? It looks like wood chip or something?
Yeah, so these are like kindling bags, mesh bags that we fill with sawdust. So the primary aim of our project is to grow food from waste, from really abundant urban waste. So we collect different waste from local businesses. The bulk of our substrate is sawdust, because the mushrooms that we cultivate in nature would decay fungi that want to break down lignin and cellulose found in wood. And then we mix the sawdust with coffee chaff, which is this very light, fluffy stuff in these bags, which is the husk of the coffee bean, which is kind of falls off the coffee bean during the roasting process. And there's actually quite a lot of coffee roasters in central Edinburgh, so it's a pretty abundant waste stream. And then the last thing we throw in there is coffee grounds, so fresh grounds from local cafes that our colleague Joe has actually just wandered off to collect for our Friday inoculations.
What do you do with the mushrooms that you've grown then?
So we sell our mushrooms through some greengrocers locally, and we also do farm door sales sometimes, very sporadically, so people can just come by. We have a little like WhatsApp chat where people can come and that people can join, and then we announce when we're going to have mushrooms for sale at the farm, and they can just come by and buy a punnet. And then we also dry some mushrooms and sell them on our website, and yeah, we eat them ourselves and eat them with our volunteers, and we're hoping that next year we can really up our growing capacity and grow a lot more mushrooms so that we can make them more available to more people.
Did you have a background in growing mushrooms before you started all of this, or has this just been a really steep learning curve?
Not at all, yeah, totally, totally new for all of us. Some of us had backgrounds in food growing in various different ways, and we all had a really strong interest in community work and kind of the kind of intersections between ecology and community and bringing people together around food and using conversations around food to open up bigger conversations about society and our relationship to nature and how our economy is structured. And really, we were looking for a project that we could start as a group of friends that would allow us to explore all those issues. Mushrooms just kind of popped up and were just such an obvious, perfect fit because they can recycle waste, because they can be grown, you know, all year round indoors, which is, you know, really resilient to any kind of climate effects. And they're kind of in a lot of ways, quite like a future-proof food in a time of increasing uncertainty about our supply chains and the climate. So we just committed to trying to start a mushroom farm, having never grown a mushroom before, and we spent the first 6 months just teaching ourselves, you know, growing mushrooms at home, while we tried to figure out what the project would actually look like, where we would set up, all the kind of steps necessary to setting up a community project.
Marco Tenconi and Mim Black there, and we'll hear more from Rise Mushrooms a little later on.
Yeah, they're super talented because they got the shipping container, and then of course they then had to fit it out, you know, they'd insulate it and all the rest of it, and they did it all themselves, and they were really determined to learn all of those skills themselves, and they went around some of the local businesses and asked if they'd anything they were going to get rid of, any materials, and they really got pretty much everything they needed for free. Mm-hmm. And they just learnt how to do it all. So they, part of their ethos is that you should be fully involved in the food production process. And if that means that you've got to kit out a shipping container,
learn how to weld.
So be it. Yeah. I do it all.
Yeah, quite. No, I've got a friend who's got a shipping container as an office. Mm-hmm. A very comfortable office. You know, it's all insulated and lined and carpeted and what have you. And, mm-hmm. you know, nice big windows in the front.
Yeah, nice.
So it's a good reuse of something, I think. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stevens, sitting me right next, well, I say right next to me, as close to the fire as she can get, Rachel Stewart, because it's about -8 this morning. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Aye, you can look the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is also available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen. which is what regular correspondent Greg Davis in Kentucky did. Says thank you as always for a great programme. The segment on seasonal affective disorder resonated strongly with me. For years I struggled with SAD, but when some years ago I started to get out more for winter walks in the woods, I found that being out of doors in the light, however muted, had wonderful effects on my mood.
He says it doesn't hurt that the beautiful golden hour is prolonged in the mornings and evenings by the tilt away from the sun by our northern hemisphere. Thanks again for being the show I look forward to most each week. With warm regards from the chilly Commonwealth of Kentucky, USA, Greg Davis.
If you fancy some company when you're tramping in the great outdoors or keeping cosy by the fire, I'd love you to join us on the Culture Scene podcast. Every week we take a burl around Scotland's arts and entertainment highlights and we hear from the folks behind them. Our guests so far have included artist Peter Howison, poet and playwright Liz Lockhead, actor Ashley Jensen and Church's Lauren Maybury. If that sounds up your street, get the kettle or your wellies on and subscribe to The Culture Scene on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts.
We have a mystery sound this week, which is a real mystery. We've only got one correct answer so far, which surprises me. But anyway, have a listen to this.
Lots of comments actually this morning. Pamela from Edinburgh, I think it could be a nuthatch tapping on a tree as it searches for food.
You did well to read that. It's tiny, tiny little writing.
Very.
Yep. Davy in a gorgeous sky winter's morn thinks it might be a thrush trying to get into a snail shell. Keir thought it might be a grouse or a capercaillie.
Craig in Bearstown, back to the guess we've had already, a woodpecker biting the wood of a tree.
Catherine Mullinsburn thinks it might be a couple of wild swimmers trying to get a swim this weekend using stones because you forgot the ice axe. You bring it on yourselves, I get no sympathy.
Anna in Condor says, is it some sort of bat? And Janet from Perth says, mighty me, it's Carl over there. You're a brave pair. We are, maybe foolish maybe. I'm like next door's cat, stuck my nose out and straight back under the duvet. Anyway, is today's mystery sound a creaking canoe or mast of a boat?
Good idea. David G says, I love that you bring your wonderful show to us from out of doors and I hope it's not too cold for you. Well, that wish is sadly disappointed, David. It is bitter this morning. Says, I woke to a lovely covering of snow with lovely paw prints, possibly the local foxes. I'll be putting my out of doors t-shirt on as part of... Where do you get an out of doors t-shirt? We don't have an out of doors t-shirt. On as part of my multi-layer approach to dealing with the cold. A bit of a long shot, but is the mystery sound wood ants or shiny guest ants? Or, Mark thinking, the tapping's a lot slower, David, when that happens. It doesn't happen often.
I like it when they think that we're clever enough to link it to the programme, to something in the programme. Yeah, clever. Very clever. If you think you know what the mystery sound is, get in touch. You can email us out of doors at bbc.co.uk. That text number, of course, is 80295. Or you can give us a ring, 0808 592 9500. Some people have just been getting in touch to tell us the temperature where they are.
Yes,
I think so far, Braemar is taking the title for the coldest place. No surprise. Yeah, minus 10?
Minus 10. Minus 10 and a half.
Yeah.
Oof. Minus 10 and a half. That is chilly. It's when you go out and you could feel it inside your nose.
Yeah. They're pretty chilly.
Yeah. Anyway, we're always getting to hear what folk get up to out and about. And this is a group that describe themselves as, and I'm quoting here directly, possibly the most prolific amateur archaeology detectives in Scotland. So you can tell they're terribly, terribly modest.
They're called the Inverclyde Time Teamers, and Paul English went along to meet them in the moorland behind Kilmacombe.
Hi, I'm Stephen McAllister, and I'm with
Alan Kinnebar,
and we are part of
the Inverclyde Time Teamers.
Now, you're both Inverclyde boys. Is this something that, as children growing up in the area, which, you know, is right in the banks of the River Clyde and, you know, looking over to the Argyll Hills, but also surrounded by a lot of wide open space, the likes of which we're in just now, is this something that sort of tickles you back then as a kid?
Absolutely. We were very fortunate that it was back in the day, go out and play, and your play area basically extended miles into the moorland, and we're very lucky to have the freedom to go and explore that open space. And now, even going up as adults, you still feel as though you're returning to your childhood and, you know, your playtime basically as a youngster, and that's a nice thing. And more recently, Alan and myself, along with Alistair and Monty, have got together as a group, and we've started to find new things that hadn't been discovered before, literally over the last 2.5 years. So yeah, we've been going for just a wee bit less than 3 years now as the collective Inverclyde Inverclyde time teamers, and we thought, you know, if we actually worked together, we would find so much more and learn from each other, and that's just the way it's panned out for us.
Well, here we go. Right, we've stumbled right into it. Which, you know, it's not something you would actually have even really noticed unless you knew what you were looking for.
Yeah, and this is a good size one, so this would be bigger than most of the structures that we would find.
Alan, tell me then, what are we looking at?
I'm thinking this one probably more likely to be an enclosure rather than a hut circle, purely because of the size of it. So your hut circles that people lived in, as opposed to kept cheap in, were typically about 78 metres across. This one's probably about 13 metres across, which makes us think enclosure. But what we're looking for is this raised profile that you can see in a circular form. And what we'll also see is the stone that you can see protruding through the grass, so that forms the circular shape. So the other thing we've got as well is you can see the C shape doesn't go all the way around.
So there's an entry point?
There's an entry point which 99% of the time would face east or southeast. And the reason it does that is it's to get away from the prevailing wind.
How old are we talking here?
They kind of designed these things from anything from potentially going all the way back to 3000 BC from the turn of the last millennium.
So this is one you know of. You've been to this one before. When you come across one of these places, what's the feeling?
In a geeky way, it's probably a bit of elation, aye. Yeah, it's not as if there's people finding these things all the time, so they're pretty rare to come across. There seemed to be a kind of wave of them that were found during like kind of 50s to the 70s. They were found and recorded. So there was a guy who, me and Stephen kind of idolised, although he's long passed away, but his name crops up and everything. Frank Yule, by the way, the archaeologist. Basically, he was given a commission to kind of mark Renfrewshire, so he found and recorded loads and loads of these things. In fact, he'd done such a good job, he's hardly left anything behind for myself and Stephen, unfortunately. So when we come across one of these, it's pretty exciting, yeah. And
we kind of thought we'd maybe find one of these and that would be a lifetime find, but I think we're up to number 16 now.
What would this indicate about the civilization, the people that were around about here?
So there's a change from prehistoric people moving around as hunter-gatherers to people that are beginning to settle down. There's a nice paper called Early Open Settlement in Renfrewshire by that name, Frank Newell again, the archaeologist, and the key word there is settlement. So where you have structures which have stone in them, which is what we have here, these aren't people that are moving around, these are people that are trying to make a go working the land and they're becoming farmers.
Right, Alan, we've come across what looks to me to be an old abandoned corrugated shed. What are we looking at?
We're looking at an old abandoned corrugated shed, which used to house the engines for the trains that would take people out grouse shooting onto Dookle Moor. So this is where they stored the engines at night time. So you've got a couple of narrow track railways heading from this shed, which headed out for miles onto the moors that took rich people like Winston Churchill and Coco Chanel.
They came here?
They came here, yeah. Yeah, grouse shooting was huge, huge in this area, as it was in Inverclyde in general. But really, 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 really huge here to build this sort of engineering project to take people out just for grouse shooting. There was obviously a fair cost involved in it, but it just shows you how dedicated they were to getting folks out to do what they wanted to do.
How did you come across the information that Winston Churchill and Coco Chanel were here?
It's kind of sparse and you have to sort of put bits and pieces together, but from what we gather, we did find one article where Winston Churchill was seen getting fitted out in shooting garments in Kilmacombe, and he would only be coming here, you know, because this was the place to go shooting. And there are many, many examples of photos where he and Coco Chanel were dressed in shooting outfits, ready to go shooting, and we know that she had came here.
Amazing.
And a calm day, if you come up to the shed, then you can still smell the cigar smoke from Winston Churchill's Havanas. I think it was Havanas he was...
Coco Chanel's perfume.
So we're now at a bridge which runs over one of the kind of local burns, and you actually get quite good views of the line where it's crossing water courses. Other than that, it's hidden under heather. But the sleepers are actually from reclaimed bits of wood from warships. So it was Sir James Lithgow, who was the shipping magnate locally. He decided to put men to work to build the grouse line because there was a downturn in orders for ships. And a lot of this is coming from scrap from the ships that were being broken up.
And how popular would it have been back in those days?
Well, if you're building a railway across moorland, which isn't an easy thing to do, there was obviously serious amounts of footfall from, you're talking about the wealthy though, King Edward VIII was up here, so you know, these are people with money, and your friends are Winston Churchill and Coco Chanel, so this isn't something that's going to be accessible to, you know, normal working class folk.
Are you bringing other people who have maybe a kind of natural curiosity for the land around about them and the area that they grew up in and the history of that? Are people kind of following what you're doing?
Absolutely. In fact, it went one better than that. We've actually had maybe more than 20 guided tours out in the local moors, and it seems to be that we've had the same lovely folk come out again and again and again and again, and they're all lovely. So most of them are actually women, and they're all fantastic bakers, so we would have ourselves a tea party up out here. In fact, they're going to be up here in a couple of weeks with us, and honestly, they make Mary Berry look like a novice. They're that good.
What would you say is the most remarkable thing that you've come across?
I think we'd all probably agree the most remarkable find that we both came across is a brand new find, the prehistoric burial cairn that we found up near Windhill Trig Point. For that to be undiscovered for that amount of time, and for us to find it, recognise what it was, and to have it verified by Historic Environment Scotland, that was probably pretty special.
Paul Inglis there with Alan Kinneborough and Stephen McAllister of the Inverclyde Time Teamers. And I think any activity, any event that's predicated upon good and reliable home baking has got to be a success.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I thought actually the answer to the question, what's the most significant find, was going to be something like a Victoria sponge. You're making me feel quite hungry now. Yeah. But just as well, because we're discussing food, back to Rise Mushrooms, a community mushroom farm in Edinburgh. You know, it's fairly easy to grow mushrooms from a kit. Have you done that?
No.
No. The kits are good if you've got kids. There is a lot to the process, though, if you're doing the whole thing from scratch, particularly if you're trying to use waste and if you're trying to do the whole thing in a very sustainable fashion. I joined Mim Black in the mixing room, and she talked me through the rather complicated recipe for growing mushrooms.
So the first stage is we go and collect our substrate. So we get our sawdust from local sawmills, from local carpenters, we get our coffee from local cafes. Then we have to clean and hydrate that substrate by submerging our substrate in a lime bath overnight. Then we do what's called an inoculation, and that's when we introduce our mycelium to the substrate. And the mycelium that we're introducing has been grown on grains because it means that we can kind of use that a little bit like seeds. And we make that at the farm. But you can buy spawn, spawn's what it's called, you can buy spawn online. So in the inoculation process, you mix your spawn with substrate, which is, yeah.
A bit of what you're doing here.
Yeah, it's exactly what we're doing here today. And we make up, basically they're called fruiting blocks, and they can be any size, but the size that we make is specific to our farm, and they're kind of like synthetic logs. And then once we've made them, we then take them to the incubation room, and they sit and myceliate. So the mycelium grows from the grains into the substrate, digesting all of that substrate, and it sits in the incubation room for 10 days to 3 weeks. And then once it's digested all of the substrate, it needs to fruit mushrooms because it's run out of food and it's looking for a new home. So then you move the fruiting blocks from the incubation room into the fruiting chamber, which is bright and breezy and wet, whereas the incubation room was dark and warm. At that stage, you're then fruiting your mushrooms from your blocks, and we normally get 3 to 4 harvests off of each of our blocks.
So it is quite an involved process, isn't it?
It is an involved process. It has a few different steps, but from inoculation to eating, it can just be a month. And you can keep doing it all the way through the year.
It actually looks like icing sugar is being sieved onto the top of that. What is that white stuff?
So that's gypsum, which adds calcium and a bit of structure to our mix.
Fungi are really intelligent, and they get bored if you feed them just the same food over and over again. They need a bit of a complex diet to get their teeth into, their enzyme teeth, to break it all down. So it just adds a bit of structure.
It must have involved a lot of trial and error, particularly at the start.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, the first few times I grew mushrooms, I grew monstrosities. Literally. They looked like little alien fingers growing out of these plastic bags in my bedroom. We've definitely learned through making lots of mistakes. And that's why, you know, we run a lot of workshops, and that's because we want to share the information that we've learned in a succinct way and make it easy for people to get started. Because, like, yeah, there's loads of information out there. There's loads of videos and books and stuff. But, like, there hasn't really been a kind of beginner's introductory 101 offering so far in person in Edinburgh or in Scotland, really. And that's what we offer. We offer affordable courses, and they're often free as well.
So we've come back into the shipping container and we're about to enter the farm itself.
Yeah, so the farm itself is divided into two rooms, which we call the fruiting chamber and the incubation room. So yeah, the bags come in here for about 10 to 20 days, and they go from looking like brown bags full of sawdust to being covered in dense white mycelium. And it's only once the fungus, the mycelium, has basically moved through the whole substrate and finished digesting it that it'll be ready to fruit mushrooms. So we move them through to the room next door, which is cool and humid and very well ventilated.
And I can see mushrooms.
You can see mushrooms, yeah. They're poking out. So we bring the bags through here, and then we just like score them and cut wee holes that the little mushrooms will be able to grow out of. And you can see some here that are just little, we call them pinheads, and they're smaller than a pea really in size. And from that size to coming close to fully mature oyster mushroom ready to harvest can take as little as 4 days in the height of summer. In the middle of winter, the mushrooms grow more slowly and they tend to be like meatier and more compact. And in summer, the mushrooms grow more quickly and tend to be a bit thinner.
They're actually really attractive to look at as well. Quite a few of them are above my head, so I can look under them. And they're very delicate, intricate structures, aren't they?
Yeah, I struggle to think of a food product more beautiful than a cluster of oyster mushrooms. And I think actually how visually compelling they are is quite central to like our ability to market them and sell them. So oyster mushrooms nowadays are quite easy to find. You can buy them at quite a few different mainstream supermarkets and a lot of Asian supermarkets, but they're never particularly fresh and they have a very short shelf life. And in our opinion, like oyster mushrooms, we want to sell our mushrooms, get them to shops and customers the day they're picked, because they are like when they're fresh and they haven't cracked and they haven't dried out and they have those deep, rich colours and you can see all their gills, they are really a sight to behold. And they're also just like incredibly cute. I mean, whenever we do markets, like people just stop and stare and they can barely believe that they're real. Like they look like little cartoonish little, you know, the little baby ones are just like
almost
really,
too
really
pretty
cute.
To eat, aren't
yeah,
they?
Almost
too pretty?
Yeah, well, you think that, but then when you realise how good they taste, you have no regrets about cooking them up. Yeah, they're a delight to cook.
That was Rye's mushrooms.
Yeah, and they're actually going to be moving to a new site in the new year. They're going to Lauriston Farm in the north of Edinburgh, which will allow them to expand and grow mushrooms outside for the first time, because one of the issues with where they currently are is that there's lots of asbestos in the site. Also because they're obviously in a very central city location, lots of rats, so they really struggle to grow anything outside just now, but they're hoping with their new location they'll be able to expand and grow mushrooms outside for the first time, probably in polytunnels. Okay. So that'll be quite exciting for them, and they do involve a lot of community groups, so they're very eager to teach people how to grow mushrooms. But as I say, it is an involved process, and I think I'll be sticking with the kits. But they do look great. Oyster mushrooms are really fascinating to watch as they're poking through the bags.
Yeah.
And they've got a separate area as well where they've got the lion's mane mushrooms as well, and again, fab to look at.
I have never heard you so enthusiastic about anything
like
before. You're into mushrooms.
I quite like them, yeah. I particularly like eating mushrooms as well.
Like a nice mushroom risotto, that's for sure. Now, we have been following the story of the Book of Dia, Scotland's longest surviving manuscript, and now a recent TV documentary on BBC Alapa tells the story of how the actual site of the monastery of Dia was discovered. Archaeologist Dr. Ali Cameron and her team made the find.
So we're just coming up to where we started the big trench with the post holes here. Uh-huh. It's really weird. When we came a few months ago, you could see the difference in the weeds. But now that some of them have died back, you can't quite see the difference as dramatically, but it started about here. Somebody said to me this morning, that was an enormous trench, and I'm like, well, we had to dig big trench. We started off small trenches in 2017 and 18, and they weren't big enough to see what we wanted to see. And so we basically
started... When you say big enough, do you mean deep enough or wide enough?
No, wide enough, yes. Okay. I mean, the depth is pretty much set by what's there, but we started off with small hand-dug trenches, but, you know, this trench, 25 by 35 metres in size. It was a big trench, you know.
That's huge.
But we didn't excavate it all. What we did was we sampled it. So we had people cleaning it and cleaning it over and over again to uncover the features that were the earliest. And we took out a few things above, but not a huge amount. And we got down onto these, the level at the bottom, which is about 60 centimetres below where we're standing. And there were post holes. And although they didn't look fantastic, they're holes in the ground where a wood has been, a wooden post has been, we didn't know that the dates were going to be so exciting. But obviously when you get the soil processed, you get the charcoal out of it, and then you send it off, so that's a process of 6 to 9 months altogether, you get an email back which gives you all these early medieval dates, which are absolutely perfect for what we were looking for, and we were astounded.
You were looking for... a monastery?
Yes.
It might be a daft question. How did you manage to lose a monastery?
Well, it's a very good question. So the abbey next to us, the Stone Abbey, was started around 1219. And, of course, the Book of Deer, which is in Cambridge University, and which we all know a lot about now after it was up here last year, you know, was not fully researched until relatively recently. They were reading these Gallic notes, which talked about the foundation of a monastery at Deer. And people obviously realised then that there was a monastery somewhere here. It's just nobody knew. I mean, this does happen, that people find things like this that are really unknown. In this case, there was a sense of it was somewhere in the area, you know, say a mile to a mile and a half from the abbey, roughly, but it's a big area. And so we started walking around and looking and seeing if we could find any evidence. We were up on the hills here. You've got Achy Bray up on the hill. You've got these other hills round about. We walked along the river and, you know... And then when we came in this field, I mean, I just thought, this is a great place. We're standing on this sort of platform, like a terrace, and then it goes just slopes down to the river. So you have to imagine this big stone wall isn't here, because this is General Ferguson, 1809, and he made this into his walled garden. So if you imagine that's not here, the river's just on the other side of where the wall is there. And so it's actually a perfect place. It's really quite beautiful here, although it's a bit snowy. The trees are fantastic. That tree, the fir, the one sticking up, the funny shape one, is where during the dig we were. It was at lunchtime, and we saw an osprey come in with a fish in its claws, and it was being bombed by two buzzards and some crows as well. And it tried. I think it did eventually land, but we watched it for ages trying to get rid of them so it could have its dinner. Amazing! This is a lovely, lovely area.
The ruins of the abbey are really quite impressive. They stand quite, you know, there's lots of courses of stone that lead up, so you can get a sense of the building. The monastery, however, have we any idea what that looked like, how big it was, what it was built of?
I mean, up till, obviously, the radiocarbon dates, we didn't really know at all. We had a number of features on the dig that we obviously had dated. Now we have a selection of features, most of which are post holes, which date from the 8th century through to the period when the Stone Deer Abbey was being built. So although that doesn't give us an impression of what this building looked like, we also have in the other trench, which is a bit further along just here, we also had some hearths. So we had two hearths which dated to around mid-12th to mid-13th century. And we had this amazing path coming towards us as we're walking now. The bedding for that dated to around the 11th, 12th century. So we've got a number of things, you know, which give us an idea of what these buildings were like. But what we think we've got is an industrial area, which is part of a much bigger thing, much bigger monastery.
What were they making?
So in the hearths, it's likely they were metalworking. Mm-hmm. So we've got slag from the layers above, but we haven't actually had it analysed yet. There's a woman in Edinburgh in the National Museum who does that, and she's going to be looking at this for us. So then we'll have a bit better idea. But it's likely they were working metal for tools and for various fittings for the buildings. And now, whether that was for the Abbey or for the buildings here, we're not absolutely certain. Very interestingly, I woke up at 5 o'clock one morning a few days ago, and I just had a sudden thought, which I've been researching, that before they built the Stone Abbey, they maybe had some wooden buildings. And I think that the latest phase in this trench where we're standing here, which essentially is three post holes in a line, you know, it's not a huge amount of evidence, but I think that it might be an early wooden monastery that the Cistercians built prior to building in stone.
What was it like actually getting the results of the, you know, the sort of carbon dating?
Oh, it was very exciting. They just come in an email.
Not right? A golden envelope, sadly.
It is not, and because they don't know what we're looking for, yeah. So they don't ask, yeah. They just date things and then send them back to us. But when I opened it, I had to read it, and they're sort of complicated. There's a graph, and you have to make sure you pick the right piece of data. And then I forwarded it on to Alice, who's my co-director, and I just sent her a text saying, look at the email. And then, of course, she had to do the same thing. But it was incredibly exciting. I genuinely did not think that that was going to be the result. I thought that the dates were going to be a little bit later. So to do with the Abbey, they were coming in the 1200s. But to have them from the 700s through to essentially the early 1200s when the Abbey was being built was amazing. I mean, it really was quite stunning.
Dr. Ali Cameron there, and you've still time to watch The Missing Monastery on BBC iPlayer.
Yeah, very interesting stuff, isn't it? Yeah, it's a significant birthday today. Apparently it's 100 years since the BBC aired its first Gaelic programme from Aberdeen.
And yeah, that was the first Gaelic broadcast, yeah, full stop.
Yeah, and you are a Gaelic scholar, so you're going to read the next link.
I'm trying to learn Gaelic, but it's a long, slow process.
Right, very difficult.
We have a mystery sound this week, so this is what it sounds like before we give you the correct answer.
You thought this was dead easy, didn't you?
And I was wrong.
Yeah, we've only got one correct guess. Yeah. Yeah, here we are. This is from Sherry, still tucked up in our bed in freezing Melrose. Quite right.
Very wise.
I think the mystery sign is a Death Watch beetle. Would be amused if amongst the wrong, but thrilled to be right. Thank you for your hours.
Be thrilled.
Fascinating diversion and interest.
Well done.
Yeah,
well, on the subject of being thrilled, we have mentioned the fact this morning it's a little on the chilly side. Wendy Ross, freezing in Falkirk, says, I missed my favourite programme the last 2 weeks. Hubby Graham and I were celebrating our 20th wedding anniversary on a Caribbean cruise.
Oh.
We left 30 degrees in Barbados on Thursday to arrive to -4 yesterday and have woken up to a few inches of snow in Falkirk this morning. Back to alkalis and porridge. And I hope you didn't get in contact, Wendy, hoping for sympathy.
Brutal, though, and congratulations on your anniversary.
Yeah, too straight. There's a bit of a sort of what's on theme going on at the moment. Gartmore Christmas Fair today at 2 p.m. in the hall. But there's also a taste there of the devilled pheasant recipe given to us by the Princess Royal for the forthcoming Gartmore cookbook.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, very nice too. And taking a break from visiting our wee huts in the woods this weekend, says Susan Waugh, can you give a quick shout out for Whitburn's Christmas cracker being held today at Whitburn Community Centre? I'm not sure when that is, but it's today at some stage. That's the leader of the Whitburn Ranger Guides.
Excellent. It is that time of year, isn't it?
Indeed. You're going to get mulled wine, you're going to get mince pies, and all sorts of interesting stuff. Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. Don't forget our New Scotland Outlaws podcast, available today to noon, and our midweek podcast, which features cider maker Christian Stalter. That's all for us this week, Emma. From all the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Hey, I hear you think podcasts are all about true crime, huh? Well, wise guy, the iHeartRadio app's got all kinds of podcasts. We got stuff you should know and stuff they don't want you to know. We got Bobby Bones, Big Boy, and Lou Later. We got SpongeBob Binge Pants and Exotic Erotic Storytime. We got Doughboys, Two Dudes in a Kitchen, Green Eggs and Dan. Hey, we got ElfQuest. We got podcasts for everything on the iHeartRadio app for free. If you don't download that, well, that's not just a true crime, my friend. That's criminal.